it was easy. Like, really. I have never been aware of it being a burden going to Tanzania, but it was such a blessing to be there. My closest friends were Tanzanians.
That's my guest, Jill Evans, on today's episode of Onward Upward. Thanks so much for joining me. My name is Dan, and it's great to have you tuning in. Maybe this is your first episode, maybe it's your 20th episode. Either way, we are so glad that you're here to hear the wonderful stories of people who call MBM home, and particularly hear about their onward and upward journey with Jesus. And Jill today is going to walk us through how she came to know Jesus from a young age and how that continued as she ventured overseas to Tanzania and ultimately coming back from Tanzania due to some difficult circumstances. There's much to be learnt, much to be encouraged by, and much to be thankful to God for. So let's get started with Jill. Well, joining me today on Onward Upward is the one, the only, Jill Evans. Jill, so good to have you with me.
Thank you, Dan.
Now, you've been at MBM for a long time. How long have you been at MBM for?
I think it's nearly 20 years.
20 years. Okay, great. 20 fun-filled years.
Mm.
So you would have been with us before the high school?
No, just after when the high school was. So that's why I can't quite remember. I can't quite remember the year.
Yeah.
Yeah, that
okay.
I came.
But you remember going to Redhill High in the
early
days?
Yeah, very yes. definitely. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. And how did you end up at MBM?
I was already going to a local church, another local church, because I moved out to a nearby suburb and I was dying spiritually. And Wendy Winters said to me, "Why don't you go to Regalia's church?" And I thought, oh, Regalia, nah.
You'd heard bad things about Regalia.
No, just because he was from Wentworthville, the Winters who were from Wentworthville, I'm from Wentworthville.
Oh, the Wentworthville gang getting back together.
Yeah, the Wentworthville gang. And I think I turned up on one Sunday when they all were away for their house party or something like that. So that wasn't a very good start. But then I just loved MBM and, yeah.
Great. Excellent. And you've stayed here ever since?
Yeah. Yeah,
wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, before you landed at MBM, you spent some time in Tanzania, which we're going to hear more about. But let's wind it back a bit more and tell us how you came to know Jesus for yourself.
I was brought up going to church, although my parents were reluctant church attenders. Dad especially hardly ever attended. Mum usually attended. And I was teaching Sunday school from a really young age, like age 13. Because I could read and write well, really, and I was teaching kids in our local church in the country. We lived in the country then. And then we moved to Sydney when my twin sister and I were 16 so that we could get jobs. Dad was a policeman. And then we went to one of the Billy Graham Crusades. And I remember my twin sister, I was sitting next to my twin sister and a couple of people from Wentworthville, and I could feel my twin sister standing up to go forward, and I thought, blow me, she's not standing up before me. So I stood up quickly before she did. So I went forward, and I remember talking to the counsellor, and she said, "Do you know John 3:16? I said, "No." And she started to say it, and I said, "Oh, yeah, I know that." You know, as if knowing that was important.
Yes.
But I didn't realise what and I think going to church at Wentworthville was the formative where I learnt stuff and where I saw being a Christian was different, but it still didn't connect. And then I remember once at a house party saying, "No, this is for me. I believe this. I want this for myself." But I was a leader at the house party at that stage, but,
okay.
You know, in a small group or something. And I want this for myself. And it was really then, but I couldn't have articulated what this was, I think. But the first time I remember was at a beach mission when I was at my grandmother's house at Bronte Beach and people talking about Jesus and being saved. That okay. was when I would have been 7 or 8.
Right, okay.
So way back then I knew about Jesus and being saved, but all these other things.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it sounded like for you, even though there was that moment at the Billy Graham Crusade, you had known about Jesus, you know, through your grandmother's house and beach mission and things like that. And it sounded like there was a progressive work there where God just kind of helped you get further understanding.
Yep. And I remember when I was about 9 in the country, we went out playing cowboys and Indians in the paddocks and we made bows and arrows and the boys were going to shoot birds and I kept praying to God that he would help us not to shoot the birds. So I always had this understanding that God was there, but it wasn't all connected.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Someone else I remember, Ray, had described in terms of their journey to faith, it's like they have all the pieces but they just kind of had a chance to put it together.
Yeah.
And that sounds like it was your story. So, Jill, you mentioned before about that you had to stand up first at the Billy Graham Crusade before your twin sister. Tell us what the relationship was like growing up as a twin.
Were you the
older one?
I was the eldest.
Okay.
But she was really the boss. Like I would defer. She knew everything that I didn't know. Like she knew everything. Ask her about a pop group. Ask her about this. Ask her about that. She would get sick of it sometimes. But she did nursing and I was a secretary, so our paths didn't cross work-wise. When we were really young, we used to swap. One of us had our hair tied on the left and one on the right, and we'd swap the way our hairs were tied, so people would get us confused. So we got on well, and she would have been my closest friend, and until probably Tanzania, and I developed other friendships, of course, and she developed other friendships and whatnot. I remember driving her and her then boyfriend, who was then her husband, to the train station. You've got to catch the train. You've got to catch the train. You've got to get to work, you know.
So you're the responsible
one. I was the responsible one.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
you've got
yeah,
her
yeah,
going
yeah,
places
yeah,
and organised.
Yeah.
Very good. It's always fascinating to hear the twin dynamic, and I guess only a certain number of people get to have that experience. We've heard a little bit about how you've spent some time in Tanzania. Was that something that was always on the cards for you?
No, it was. I read a book by R.T. France and I wanted to know about this chesed love that God had for his people. So I took myself off to Bible college and in Bible
college. Chesed is a Hebrew word for covenantal love.
Yeah, covenantal love.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, so I'd got that
and
a bit through reading. And I'd had a couple of really good ministers who also were teaching sort of the whole gospel, if you like. So I got a different view of God at that age, sort of age 21 or so, and took myself off to Bible college and there had a real sense of God calling me to be a missionary. And I thought, what? I'm a secretary. They don't have secretaries as missionaries. But I applied to CMS, scared stiff that they would accept me because I was known. I used to teach at summer school, teach the kids at summer school. I worked in the diocesan offices, so I was afraid that I was going to be accepted by my good works sort of thing. And I was. And that's how I got to Tanzania, really.
Right, okay.
But I really, even at that stage, didn't really understand the gospel.
Okay.
I don't know how I got through.
You managed to get through all those interviews and assessments and say all the right things and write down all the right things at Bible college.
I sort of knew them theologically, I think, and I knew them sort of theoretically, but how to articulate the gospel myself, I don't know that I would have known. I don't know whether I still don't know whether I would have known then.
Right.
I learned a lot in Tanzania.
Okay. Even though you actually now sit on the panel that approves candidates to go for missionary training for CMS. CMS stands for Church Missionary Society. Just talk me through the vantage point of now you being the first part of a panel that gives a thumbs up or thumbs down to people who go on the mission field. If you had seen yourself come through.
I have. I made at the time a suggestion that something should be done about the way this particular person was articulating the gospel because it didn't sound to me as if it was – the theological answers were correct, yes, you could tick all those off, but the personal examples of how they were articulating the gospel weren't gelling to me.
Okay.
and
there
I
was some sort of a disconnect.
Yeah,
there
was a disconnect, but only one out of all the ones I've interviewed.
Okay,
you're all okay.
That's good. We love CMS, and they do wonderful work.
Yeah, but that's why it's such a wonderful process, because it does sort wheat from chaff, but it sorts good from good as well, or good or not yet.
Yes,
you know, even the not yets.
That's right.
It's just a wonderful process.
So talk us through then how that played out for you, because, you know, here you are, you're looking back on this, you realise that this personal grasp of grace didn't fall into place until you got to Tanzania. How did that come about?
Well, I was in my bedroom reading Knowing God. I was given that as a gift in Perth by friends who were still in Perth. We were on beach mission together, and I stopped with them for 3 or 4 days before I went out the very first time in 1974, and they gave me Knowing God. And that was my sort of salvation, if you like. Many times in Tanzania when I was feeling down or was confused, I'd go back to that because I had all the underlined bits that I knew that I needed to be reminded of.
My copy's got plenty of underlined bits.
I've still got that.
Okay, so you've got Knowing God there, you're in Tanzania. What kind of work were you involved in Tanzania?
The first place I was a secretary to the bishop, but on the side I did whatever else needed doing. So in the very first place where I was still learning language, I taught a little girls' club and we did sewing. I think me sewing, but I did it, you know, it was amazing.
You just adapted.
I look back. Yeah. And then the second place, the bishop wanted all of his missionaries be able to work with locals, so he appointed me to work in a local suburban church. So I was there every Sunday instead of going to the cathedral. I'd go to this little local church out in the outer suburbs. So, so I worked within that church and I taught a confirmation class there on behalf of the pastor, but he didn't like the way I taught because I didn't teach them by rote, so they couldn't say what it, in the catechism it says, what is your name, and your answer is N or A M. You know, even in Swahili it's N or M sort of thing. I didn't teach them the catechism like that, and the pastor came and grill them on the catechism and they failed.
Right, okay.
So he took over after that.
Okay. Now, this is not your first time that you've had experience in recording audio. You were telling me before about some tapes that you were recording. Can you share with us what that looked like?
Yeah, well, I wasn't doing the recording, but I live with the girl who was there to do the recording of the local language into the Bible, into stories into the local language. And she set up or organised how to got a building built, money to build the building, and I remember we insulated it with, I think, using egg cartons because that softened the sound.
Yes.
And we had to wait. We wanted to do Noah. And we had to wait for the wet season to get the rain on the roof to give the sound effects. And I remember going out to a village. And because that was in the day in Tanzania where they were bringing tiny, small kin groups who lived in little grass thatched huts into bigger villages, sort of thousands and thousands of people. So making a central school, market, a little dispensary, come little mini hospital. That was the idea. And so we went to this particular village and the people there were saying, oh, that's the Bible in our language. That's in our language. That's the radio in our language teaching the Bible. You know, that was all they understood us to be doing. We had hand-wound cassettes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So no electricity just because of...
There's definitely no electricity. Yeah. We didn't have electricity. Yeah.
And when you say translating into local languages, I imagine there's a number of different dialects and things like that. So how many... Do you remember how many?
That was just that local language. It was Giha.
Okay.
So the bishop used to say, we are called Waha, we speak Giha, and we laugh Ha Ha. Yeah, so.
Sounds like an entertaining bishop. He had a few jokes up his sleeve. Okay. Now, I'm keen to get back to this story of how grace kind of fell into place, because On the one hand, grace is one of those things that just makes sense, but at the same time, it doesn't make sense because it's so radical. It's how God works it to the opposite of what we would expect. So how did that play out for you, Jill?
Well, it turned everything on its head because it meant God was undergirding everything that was happening, even if it didn't look like it sometimes. So I knew that God was in control, and it was only by his grace that I was where I was and that he had even ordained where I was. So even in the first place I lived and worked, the first tour was a very happy tour, the second tour wasn't. But even that, the learnings that I got from the things that happened that second time, and then to see God's hand at work when I went and worked in Morogoro, working with a really godly bishop who loved Jesus, that was such a blessing to me. Whatever situation you are in, God is there enabling the situation to be. It's not happened randomly. If you don't have God's grace undergirding that particular situation, it's hopeless.
It's one of those things because you had given up a lot to go over to Tanzania.
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, just the thought of even getting over there.
I know. Yeah. But it for me.
And learning a new language.
That was easy. Like, really?
Okay.
I honestly don't think I have never been aware of it being a burden going to Tanzania, ever. And it's not that I want to be back there now because I don't. I know the realities of living in Tanzania and I don't want those realities. But it was such a blessing to be there. My closest friends were Tanzanians every place I lived.
As opposed to, say, the other missionaries.
Yeah, definitely.
What was it like? I think you've just answered it, by the way, that you were saying that some of your best friends were the Tanzanians. What was it like being a single Caucasian woman going into an African country? You obviously were received well,
yes,
to the extent that you had some of your best friends there, but was there any fear or uncertainty as you were heading in?
No. There was one time when I was attacked, myself and my flatmate in the second place I lived. She and I went up to the river for a walk and we were threatened on the way back with a guy who took off his belt to attack us with, and a big stick. He picked up a big stick. And I had we had thermoses and camera and stuff because we'd taken up morning tea or something. And on his belt was this big buckle with love, joy and peace.
The irony of what he's about to do.
That is the only time. And then after that, someone tried to break into my house and I woke up to the creaking. The window had been boarded up and I woke up with someone trying to prise open the window, and I yelled out in Swahili, get the hell out of here, or go away or something, and he went away. And I went round the next morning to see whether there were footsteps there, and yes, there were footsteps there. So I hadn't imagined it or anything, but my heart was beating and then heart wouldn't settle down. But that's the only time I only ever felt honoured and treated as an honoured guest. And it didn't matter whether we were with Tanzanian men or, with pastors, but I only ever felt treated like an honoured guest and a sister to everybody.
That's wonderful. Yeah, that's great to hear. Now, there was some times there that weren't as memorable, like a time that you tried to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. Now, for many people, this is on their bucket list. This is the sort of thing that they go over to Tanzania for.
Yes.
But tell us about your experience.
My experience was that I exercised as well as I thought I could in Kasulu, the place where I was living. It took me about 4 days to get there by bus and train, and to meet up with the girls I was going with, and then we went together. And I remember the bus from Mwanza, which is top left of Tanzania, across to Mount Kilimanjaro, stopped in the middle of the desert, really, or the middle of the plains, and to go to the toilet as a toilet stop. And they said men to the left and women to the right sort of thing. No facilities whatsoever. But one of the men stopped me and he said, you see over there way in the distance what looks like trees? And I said, yeah. And he said, they're zebras. I said, what? like it was the beginning of the migration with the zebra, and it was just like little, so far in the distance, it was like little trees. And anyway, so we got to Mount Kilimanjaro.
Hang on, sorry, but you're trying to go to the toilet.
Yeah.
But the zebras weren't approaching.
No. Oh, they were way, like so far away that they were little dots.
Oh, okay.
And he was showing me these little dots in the distance. Yeah.
So I thought there was a bit of pressure
there. No pressure. The pressure was trying to go to the toilet with a group of other women. They're used to squatting, you know, I'm not. That was the difficulty. But anyway, but at Mount Kilimanjaro, I didn't have – well, I had closed-in shoes, but I didn't have walking shoes, and my shoes were bruised because on the way down, my toes would just kept digging into the thing. And I remember I was going up. The guide said, "Don't worry, you'll get there. Look, we had someone the other day who wasn't even here by this hour." And I said, "Did they get to the top?" "No." So I was so tired, I couldn't swap a lolly from one side of my mouth to the other.
Wow. And I'm sure our listeners are trying to just imagine that movement of a lolly.
It's the thinking of the lolly and the moving it from it's the brain. And I couldn't swap the camera from one arm to the other, so the guide took the camera.
Wow.
It was exhausting, but I'm so glad. I didn't go up to the top. I thought when I got to the hut, before you go to the hut that you go to in the middle of the night to go to the top, I thought, this is supposed to be a holiday. I'm not supposed to be killing myself. So yeah. I let my two friends go up and they went up and...
Okay, and you waited for them to come back down.
Yeah. And that was great because you went to the toilet and the toilet was facing the clouds on the top of a cliff and you were above the clouds going to the loo. You could open the door and see out. It was amazing.
There you go. I wouldn't have thought toilet stories and Mount Kilimanjaro would come together, but they have... You can do it while the zebras are migrating or up the top of the clouds.
It was amazing. Oh, that was an amazing trip.
Wow.
And the flora and the fauna was beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, well, you've inspired those of us who have it on the bucket list to want to get there.
Yes, please do.
Yes. Now, you were also, while you were in Tanzania, involved in a particular outreach event in Dar es Salaam. Tell us what that outreach event looked like. Was this similar to a Billy Graham event that you had experienced here in Sydney?
Yeah, it was as big as sort of like a Billy Graham event because I was seconded in my last 2 years, 3 years to African Evangelistic Enterprise, AEE, and I was in a bit of limbo, but my job was to write. Dar es Salaam was due to have a whole city evangelistic campaign. So my job was to write the sort of follow-up lessons that people were going to be given and plan so that they could, when people were converted, they could be actually fed into local their own local churches.
Yeah, very important stage, you know, not just saying yes at a one particular event, but helping them go over the gospel again and get established in the life of a church, yeah.
And the crusade was to be in October or something, 1991. And in January 1991, that's when my twin sister rang and said, "I have this sense that I need you at home."
We're going to pause Jill's story right there, but make sure you tune in next week as we hear the second half of Jill's story and particularly hear how she responded. What did she do next after getting that phone call from her twin sister back from Sydney? Well, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Onward Upward. It's been a fantastic season. Jill is going to be my last guest on this podcast. As we get ready to hear next week's episode, I want to give a big thanks to those of you who have tuned in, week out, who've sent messages of encouragement and thanks and appreciation. It's been so awesome to hear from the many and varied people who call MBM home, and they all have one thing in common. They are people who have been transformed by Jesus for God's glory, and they continue to be transformed. And that's the beautiful thing about hearing these stories week after week after week, is that we can thank God for His work. Well, until next week, we'll see you then.